Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 26th, 2005. Today's session, Making Christian Sense of Contemporary Popular Music, presented in the Fireside Room by Peter Mercer Taylor. Disc number MEP-2005-07. Let's listen in.
A quick show of hands, just so I can get my feet under me here. How many of you were not here last evening for our first session? A couple. Okay, well then I think the two of you who just raised your hands know enough about me. I will skip over introductions quickly. Once more, I'm Peter Mercer Taylor. Teaches at the University of Minnesota. I'm an associate professor of musicology there, a Mendelssohn scholar and a popular music scholar in sort of equal parts in my work there, both as a scholar and as a teacher. Last night we had an opportunity to begin the conversation about how certain basic sort of thematic configurations in popular music mirror or parallel certain configurations in the Christian experience and in Christian orthodoxies of various kinds. And we're going to be broadening out that conversation this evening, dealing with three songs, if we have a chance to get to them all, with three songs that, in a sense, can't be grouped along thematic lines. These songs are all on roughly the same topic, or speak from something like the same situation. There are three songs sung by folks to and about someone who has died, a beloved who has died. In the first case, this is a beloved who has died due to violence, actually in September 11th events. It's from Bruce Springsteen's album, The Rising, all of which was crafted as a response to the events of September 11th, and we're going to be listening to his song, Empty Sky. Moving from there to a song from the soundtrack of the film Cold Mountain called Scarlet Tide, sung from a woman to a man. I'm not going to get around to revealing too much about the plot of this film, but a Civil War, a man involved in the Civil War, and this woman has had to face the fact of his death. And finally, if we have time, against my better judgment, we'll be listening to the love theme from Titanic and talking about
Titanic 2.
That's right. And we'll see how that goes. I'm going to pass handouts upstairs just so we can begin disseminating these. But I have a... Can you reach over the loom? I'm sorry. I have a special request. The song on the front of this is Bruce Springsteen's Empty Sky. I want to get it in front of you so we can get the part about handing it around out of the way. Don't read it yet. There are things that occur in this song that are extremely important that you experience temporally, that you don't know what's coming as it's coming. You have to be surprised by them if it's a song you happen not to know yet. So don't read ahead. Just pass out ahead and go ahead and circulate these things. But I know
exactly who sings the left in the text. Name Dion.
That's right.
And for me, when I first saw that movie, I was like, oh my gosh, what the hell is going on here? This movie, because I think for me, the real Titanic actually hit an iceberg. Yeah. But for me, yep. It's like the idea of the moral of Titanic, the movie.
Yeah, and it's Celine Dion's finest hour. I think most of us could agree for what that's worth. But we're going to begin with Bruce Springsteen. As I said, a song from an album, the sort of lead-off song from an album that Bruce Springsteen crafted around the experience of September 11th. And this song lays out a certain kind of agenda. And again, I would ask you not to read it yet, but it's an agenda crafted, in a sense, around biblical imagery, crafted around a kind of religious experience. And in a sense, I would like to think that the religious experience, or the invitation to think of the events of September 11th in religious terms, is what this song holds out to us. It's not simply a song about somebody's death. It's a song about what else this experience might mean. And I think the kinds of problems it poses to a Christian person faced with this event, faced with the kind of document Springsteen has put before us, well, it gives us much to think about. As we'll discover, as we move from song to song in tonight's conversations, the songs, in fact, raise very different issues. Not only do they respond to the tragedies at their heart in different ways, but they stand in different relationships to this whole conversation. I mean, in terms of the question, are we talking about songs with Christian imagery, with biblical imagery? Well, sometimes we are, but sometimes we're simply talking about songs that address, say, the issue of the afterlife in a particular way, or the possibility of an afterlife, just how, in the broadest terms, we're supposed to respond to somebody's death, how we're supposed to think about death. The songs get, in a sense, less explicitly religious as we make our way through this evening's offerings. I don't want to say a whole lot about Springsteen's Empty Sky before we listen to it. It's a fiercely, adamantly simple song. There are only three chords in the entire song, we hear them all right at the outset. It's a song that I also have to admit up front. One quick show of hands. How many of you think you know this song? Think you've ever heard it? Right. Not too many. It's a song that's really hard to like. It's a song to be too fond of. Those of you here last night, remember we began the proceedings with Bruce Springsteen's Victorious Born to Run, sort of him at his most sort of rock-like, him and this sort of anthemic rock masterpiece that he produced in 1975. He has mellowed with the years and has obviously, he has different things to address at this point in his career, different ways to try to get his message across. The way he gets his message across in this particular song is quite austere and in a sense quite hard to like. That is, it's not an especially user-friendly song, not a sound that we feel ourselves able to kind of ease into or to feel ourselves pushed along by or anything else. It's hard to say quite what he's trying to accomplish with this particular sound. The only chords we get in the song are this one, and this one. And we have to work our way with sort of various configurations of these three chords. It's with these that we have to content ourselves. It is not a lush production by any means. It's quite spare and quite brutal in a certain sense. And I think this sort of underlying sense of brutality may well have something to do with what he has to offer us here. Let's just give the song a listen. And of course, as it unfolds, you may read along, but don't read ahead.
Thank you.
hope you walk away with from this song?
Yeah. I know it's not the bottom line, and the bridge, and then the last part, all have one thing in common, it's part of the song. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's part of the song, not very intense. And that's that money, that moment, money, I just make up the radio. Mm-hmm. No, I don't think I'm an artist. Oh, not something like that. Pain. Not what the heck is something problem.
Great, great. That's interesting. We listened to Boston's More Than a Feeling yesterday, also about sort of waking up in the morning.
I kept waiting for the meaning of empty sky to change somehow by the end.
Why?
Just because that's what, from a songwriter's point of view, a good chorus does. Mm-hmm. You know, there's something in the verses that make the chorus different by the time you got to the end of the song.
Right.
And I felt like it was still, it was just kind of oneness of,
interesting.
Of meaning.
Interesting.
Go ahead. I think that's the color of the song. It doesn't resolve. Mm-hmm. When you lose someone, the sky's empty. It's gone. Mm-hmm. There's nothing. I mean, if you lose someone, you know, a spouse or really a child, mm-hmm. the sky's empty. Mm-hmm. And in here, he wants revenge. Mm-hmm. Even though, in this case, you say 9/11, but it doesn't matter.
Right.
Why the death?
Right.
You'll blame someone.
Right.
I mean, there's a blaming. You know, why don't you take him away?
Yeah. And you're opening, well, several kettles of fish going on the fire right now. I want to be sure as we move into this, the sort of critical question facing us in the song, that we all understand what Paul, a very good songwriter himself, is talking about when it comes to a chorus reshaping itself. If we think, for example, of a recent classic country song, this is half the art of country songwriting, is crafting a chorus that will ultimately have two meanings. So, for example, a woman comes home in the first verse of this recent country song and says to her husband, "You know, I was walking along and I glanced into this cafe downtown and there were this man and the woman and they just seemed to be so much in love and it was a beautiful thing. And then, she gets into the chorus, I guess he had to be there. And she realizes she can't really communicate what she means to communicate about this couple. I guess he had to be there. And she gets through the same verse and kind of winds up in the same place. And in the third verse, she reveals that the man that she saw in the cafe was him, was her husband, out having an affair with another woman. And she realizes that this has to do with sort of the failings of their marriage, to which she's finally coming to terms. And at last, she gets to the same chorus, but, you know, I guess he had to be there. And she understands at last he has to be in that cafe with this other woman. And Paul, I assume that's the kind of thing you're talking about.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, something that becomes much more profound by the end than it was at the beginning. So what is this about the empty sky? What do you mean the sky is empty?
It's lost. It's gone. Yeah. Whatever your world was,
yeah.
Part of it's gone. It's never coming back.
Right. Okay.
Does it mean that there's no God in the sky? Or, you know, what's not in the sky that used to be there?
Right. Well, what about that? Yeah. Is that what we all think? Or is this thought just striking us for the first time?
God's in the sky.
God is not in the sky.
But God
denies. Yeah.
I just thought the Twin Towers, empty sky, the skyline doesn't have, that's all I'm interested
in. Yeah, yeah.
Well, I thought there was a dual meaning that where was God? Why didn't God arrange all this stuff not to happen?
Yeah, right. So what the heck is this empty sky?
I see a lot of confusion between an eye for an eye, a kiss from your lips, these twin desires, and even further on in the song. How am I supposed to react to this particular tragedy of this tree of evil, of this tree of good? I'm cutting my bow. But why? And there's a lot of confusion and unresolved.
Right, right.
Confusion.
Right. And the reason I was so adamant about you all not reading ahead in this thing is so we wouldn't get to that line first. So in a certain sense, and obviously after the prelude I gave it, you can't possibly be deceived. I told you this is a song about September 11th. I told you it's a song about loss. But if I hadn't, if we had to experience this the way that the literary critic Stanley Fish is always talking about, just the process of reading, and that reading is a temporal process through which you learn things, expectations are set up, expectations are thwarted. We must think of reading as a temporal thing. We must think of listening as a temporal thing. Temporally, as we make our way through the first verse of this song, If you didn't know what the song is about, you would think it is a love song. We've heard this song about a million times. A song about a guy, he wakes up, there's his, he wants to have his beloved next to him, but she's gone. That is, I woke up this morning, I could barely breathe, just an empty impression in the bed where you used to be. There's a typo on the sheet, sorry. I want a kiss from your lips. Well, this far we've got a love song. I mean, this could be a song about sort of love gone bad and she's gone. I want a kiss from your lips. I want an eye for an eye. And the moment that this sort of eye for an eye thing comes after us, you know, we realize she's not gone because she left him, she's gone because she's dead. And that he's not dealing with sort of love gone bad, he's dealing with, well, this massive loss. And the way that this thing washes over us, the way that our footing simply falls out from under us, the floor falls out from under us with this line, I want an eye for an eye, it's very powerful. I'm curious, where do you sense the ambivalence? That is, what's the big question here? He wants revenge. She's dead. He wants revenge. What's ambivalent?
But he knows. He knows it's a tree of evil and a tree of good.
Yeah.
He knows. Yeah. He shouldn't.
Yeah. Right. Well, there's something about pop songwriting. I have to just get off the bus here for a second and suggest to wrap this all up into the conversation we're having about this chorus and these two words, empty sky. This is what pop music does, I think, at its very best. Pop music cannot have the scope of Moby Dick. You can't work out your metaphors on that scale. I mean, pop music just doesn't have that many words. It has to go by fast, and it doesn't want to beat you over the head. So what can you do? You lay out imagery that can cut several ways. Why is the sky empty? Well, the sky is empty because these two buildings have fallen down. But the sky is also empty because perhaps there is no God. And perhaps in an even more mundane sense, the sky is empty because the day after September 11th, no airplanes were flying. And it was very strange. Americans in New York having to live without any airplanes. And I mean, so there are many different things that we mean saying the sky is empty. But in a certain sense, the way that he sets up this first verse, where he says, okay, here's this thing. It could be a love song. It could be mundane. It could be something you've dealt with a thousand times before, yet it is not. It is not mundane. There's this deeper meaning that we're talking about. We're talking not about loss, simply the loss of a loved one to somebody else. We're talking about death. And in a certain sense, it seems as though he is inviting us to do precisely this with his chorus, to say, okay, we're not just talking about an empty sky because those buildings fell down. We're not just talking about there being no planes flying. We're talking about the loss of God. We're talking about a sky, or a world that no longer can accommodate our old concept of God. Perhaps. I don't know. But the way that first verse unfolds seems to me to teach us to sort of work through this song on a quest for the second meaning, for the deeper meaning. It just seems like a beautiful piece of art to me. Let me ask a question. You all will have noticed, I suspect, that he switches his articles there. Sometimes he's talking about an empty sky. Sometimes he's talking about the empty sky. Nothing's more fun than asking questions. I don't have a clue what the answer is, but this is one of those. What is he doing there? Why does it matter whether it's an empty sky or the empty sky?
An empty sky would mean it's new. Mm-hmm. Like it's like when we say, I saw a tree today, or I met a new person today. When we use it's new, and then the second time we say the.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Very nice.
Indefinite article, doesn't that mean possibility for more than one? An indefinite article, that means there's only one.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I worship the God as opposed to I worship a God. It, you know, it makes a difference, yeah.
Well, it sort of progresses, too. I mean, the first time it's true, it's an empty sky, so it's loss and emptiness, but then it gets into the blood and the crying and all that, so it becomes more, broader in scope and more tragic.
Right. Now, there is tragedy here. Obviously, this is a sad song, and it's very hard to put our fingers on what precisely is so sad. He's just got, five notes to work with in this chorus, but the way he strings them together, it is just hopelessly tragic. Yet it's more than tragic. I mean, what do we do with the anger of this song? I mean, what is so discomforting here is the sense that he's driving us to a theology that we can't possibly believe in, this idea of wanting an eye for an eye. After we've been through the Sermon on the Mount, and there's not any need probably to quote the Sermon on the Mount, when Jesus says, you've heard that that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist an evildoer. But if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn the other also. This is obviously the way that the Old Testament has of talking about an eye for an eye is some of the most uncomfortable parts of the Old Testament. For example, when the Israelites are faced with a blasphemer, his mother's an Israelite, his father's an Egyptian, he drifted into town, he blasphemed, and we learn in Leviticus what God tells Moses to do to this person. The Lord says to Moses, take the blasphemer outside the camp. And let all who are within hearing lay their hands on his head, and let the whole congregation stone him, and speak to the people of Israel, saying, anyone who curses God shall bear the sin. One who blasphemes the name of the Lord shall be put to death. The whole congregation shall stone the blasphemer. Aliens as well as citizens, when they blaspheme the name, shall be put to death. Anyone who kills a human being shall be put to death. Anyone who kills an animal shall make restitution for it, life for life. Anyone who maims another shall suffer the same injury in return, fracture for fracture, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. The injury inflicted is the injury to be suffered. These aren't words that are very easy to live by. And Deuteronomy puts it more simply, show no pity. Life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. Yeah.
That's the law.
Yeah.
And the way I understand it, I'm not an Old Testament scholar, that's exactly it. It's an eye for an eye. It's not an eye for a life. I mean, if someone takes out your eye, you don't get to take their life. Yeah. It has to be an equal response.
Yeah.
Great. And I don't know if a lot of the American population understands that.
Yeah.
Or if Springsteen even understands that.
Yeah. Is this a pro-war song, or you've got another question?
Well, I was just wondering about that. The next line there. Not the next line. I hear the blood of my blood crying from the ground. Is that a reference back to Genesis 3 or 4? I'm sorry, where the blood God says, Cain, the blood of your brother cries from the ground.
And therefore, if it were indeed such a reference, and let's assume it is, you're the Old Testament scholar, which he is. This is my father, by the way. Sorry. what do we do with that? I mean, that is, does this leave? I mean, is this his way of passing judgment on the conclusion he's arrived at, or what do you?
Well, I mean, that's the first murder, the first time you have two people in a family who get off by themselves, one kills the other. I mean, it just seems to be sort of built into us.
Yeah, yeah, right.
And tendency.
Yep. Yet, presumably, he isn't saying, Bruce Springsteen pulling out this imagery, he's not saying, remember the good old days, Cain and Abel. I mean, that is, we're not being happy about the fact that we're having to re-enter the Garden of Eden only to leave it again. I mean, he's talking about the tree of evil, the tree of good. You know, and he returns to the sort of moment of He's returning to the moment of sort of man's primal sins. As you say, the first murder, the transgression in the Garden of Eden. And he's saying, well, this is where this leaves me. I mean, I've got this woman and she's dead. And I'm just sort of thrust back to all these sort of primal moments of sinfulness, to these sort of feelings that always lead us astray. I mean, is that a reading you can accept of this moment in Genesis that you're,
How do you know it's a woman?
We don't. That's just old heterocentric me.
I was going to mention, is he being a bit disingenuous in that he says this tree of evil and this tree of good, whereas if we're exchanging Genesis metaphors, it's the knowledge of the tree of good and evil.
Yeah.
I wrote
that word.
So what do you think? Do you think this kind of doesn't know the Bible well enough, or do you think he's really trying?
Okay, that's a possibility. That's a good one, I would probably say. But it may also be that he's reflecting the Cain and Abel situation and not the condition of fallibility, which was what Adam and Eve got themselves into.
Yeah.
It wasn't exactly, correct me here, a sin to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, but they did so in a
Why not?
I think whatever else this is, it's poetry.
Yeah.
And you don't have to spell, you know, the whole system out. I mean, you know, I'm not sure what I think of as handling the tree of evil and tree of good, but whatever it does call forth something, right. And that's all the intention.
Yeah. Something is being summoned. I mean, some sort of body of understanding is suddenly being sort of funneled into this situation.
Right. Great. If we don't press on, we're not going to get to everything. Let's press on. I don't want to say too much about the details of the end game of the film Cold Mountain, but go ahead and flip over this sheet. The setup of Cold Mountain, this movie, quick show of hands. How many have seen the movie Cold Mountain?
I'm not.
Okay, very good. The Miramax flick came out, I know, a couple years ago. A very good story based on a much better novel by Charles Frazier. Is that the novelist? His first novel, and it's just a smashing effort. It's a Civil War story about a woman who happens to be the daughter of a minister. And at a certain point, toward the dawn of the Civil War, she began to have this relationship with this man, where it became clear that they both were exceedingly interested in one another, but this became clear just in a couple of very intense kind of encounters that they had. And all at once, he is snatched off into the jaws of the Civil War. He goes off to fight for the South. They live in the South. And he goes off to sort of fight this fight, and they just don't hear from each other for a long, long time. Neither one of them is quite sure what their status is, but the narrative is split between his story of having, basically after an injury, he decides to just make his way home. He just vacates his post, he walks out of the hospital, goes AWOL, and begins to make his way home. She, meanwhile, is at home trying to keep a farm running. Her father has died, and she's trying to keep a farm running with the help of this other woman who's a kind of local girl who knows a lot more about running a farm than she does. So we have these two women on the one hand and this man trying to make his way home. Whether the man survives or not, I really don't want to say a whole lot about. But for all intents and purposes, we must accept this as a song about the man having not survived. This is the kind of theme song of the movie, and it's a song about this woman contemplating the death of this fellow that she loved. That she watched him sort of disappear into this machine, which was the Civil War, a war that neither of them supported in any way, and she has to come to terms with his loss. And it's this loss that the song is about. And we're dealing here with Elvis Costello and T-Bone Burnett. T-Bone Burnett, these are two writers of the song. T-Bone Burnett is himself a great folk musician, a very good songwriter, but much better known for his life as a producer of film music. He produced the soundtrack to O Brother, Where Art Thou, for which he won a Producer of the Year award. And this was O Brother, Where Art Thou, a previous Coen Brothers movie, was really a movie through which he really utterly rethought the role that cinema might play in the American sort of reclamation of its own religious musical past. It was a very, very exciting movie and a very exciting soundtrack. And Cold Mountain accomplishes a certain number of the same things. He gathered around this soundtrack a bunch of very interesting singers involved in what we now call American roots music of one kind or another. There's sacred harp, shape note singing that sounds pretty authentic and is pretty authentic, and all kinds of very interesting sort of authentic sounding folk music. This is not an authentic sounding piece of folk music. This is an Alison Krauss song that he wrote very sparsely accompanied, and in keeping with the sort of folk tone of much of this music. We have two instruments here, a piano and a cello, and we have these two voices. Alison Krauss sings and is accompanied by another female voice on the choruses. A very spare sound, and that much is very much in keeping with the entire musical tenor of the film, but it doesn't really purport to be a piece of folk music. This is it's a pop song written around these kind of themes of the movie, the theme of this woman, her loss of this man, and perhaps other things as well. Without further ado, let's listen to this thing. The things I'd like you to keep your eye on as we make our way through this song include, for example, the kind of metrical peculiarities. It's metrically a very strange song. I'd like to make several trips over here for CD. We're dealing, too, with Elvis Costello. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Elvis Costello's career, the whole trajectory of his career. He exploded out of the starting gates in 1977. He thought it would be cute to adopt the name Elvis, as his first name. His real name is Declan Patrick McManus. But he took this name, Elvis, as his first stage name. What? I'm sorry?
Sounds
From Elvis Presley.
That's right, from Elvis Presley, only to have Elvis Presley die a couple of months before the release of his first album. So it came off as the most tasteless joke in the world that he has named himself after this great pop icon for whom the world turns out to be mourning at this moment. Very unfortunate. But Elvis Costello immediately established himself as one of the great songwriters of the new wave generation. It was the first great blush of creativity after the punk explosion, and he showed that you could kind of take the very simple materials of punk and funnel them into outstanding songwriting, endlessly fascinating songwriting. Elvis Costello and the Attractions, his sort of punky first band, they rapidly released about 5 albums in the space of 3.5 or 4 years. The songwriting is all outstanding, and the critics just couldn't get enough of this guy, and he's continued to reinvent himself. He's since worked with the Brodsky Quartet on a neat project. He collaborated with Burt Bacharach for an album, and he has just done endlessly interesting things. And is just a fascinating songwriter. But as with Bruce Springsteen, somebody who is capable of accomplishing great things with very few supplies. He can do much with little. And I think he does much with little in this song. Let's give it a listen. Pay attention in particular to the sort of metrical peculiarities of it, the way the measures don't ever quite seem to add up, and at the same time to the instrumentation. Spare as it is, very interesting things happen, where just that piano, the voices, and the cello are concerned. Perhaps than Bruce Springsteen did. Similar situations, terrible upheavals in the world, leave the lover dead, we have to assume. Let's pretend he dies. Let's pretend he dies in the Civil War. I don't want to say any more about this movie. But mourning the loss of a lover to momentous human upheavals, yet the responses are very different between this and Empty Sky. What do we do with this response? What does it accomplish, Eric?
And I think there are just harmony.
Yeah, right. There is. What about that? That is that there is this harmony on the chorus, and this is a perhaps critical thing. What do we think about the significance of the arrangement of this thing?
That's very too mellow.
It's what? I'm sorry.
It is way too mellow.
It is extremely mellow. That's right. And in a certain sense, there's a way in which this is what really puts it in line with much of the folk music in this movie. That is, it's not a movie about snare drums sort of pounding away on backbeats. There's an awful lot of exceedingly mellow sort of folk music in this film. And this speaks from that world. It doesn't speak that language, but it speaks from this world. I think powerfully in the end, yeah.
It has a little sense, not just of folk, but of a hymn. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Great, great. Yeah.
I like the addition of the, where the solo becomes a duet, because it's really a metaphor for women who are rising together.
Great.
Above the scarlet tide.
Okay.
And it shifts there from I to we. We'll yeah. rise above the scarlet
that's
tide.
Excellent. That's just, mm-hmm.
Okay.
We'll,
so there are these two women, and that's what the movie is about. It's about two women. It's also about this guy.
The Civil War was such a bad, bad thing happening, but there still was hope. Even
right.
though the bad things were happening in the, she's a widow.
Right.
They were rising above that.
Yeah, great. And there's this thing about just this community of women and mutual support. This is one of the important lessons of the movie. Who is the third character in the movie? I already told you. He's this guy making his way home.
Mm-hmm.
Is he in the song?
No.
Are we sure?
Yeah.
No, he doesn't have words anymore. That's right.
His
well, words.
Back. He says, "Why did I want
him
to lose?"
Just to lose him again.
What
so, if we wanted him in the song, if he were in the song, where would he be singing? How would his voice work its way in there? Would it be higher, lower? What would he be doing?
Mid-range.
Mid-range, perhaps. Lower, probably.
Like cello.
A cello, for goodness sake. What are we doing with a cello in this song? And as the song unfolds, the cello becomes more and more prominent. That is, that it's originally playing nothing but a bass line, but as the second verse unfolds, especially as we get past that first sort of problematic, quatrain, whatever we call these things, first four line, as she begins, the dark of night was swiftly fading, the cello sort of sets off on a journey of its own. Bum, ba, da, da. I'm not going to be able to sort of call it all to mind. We're going to listen to it again. We're just going to listen to the song again and keep our eyes on that cello line with this thought in mind, that in fact, the guy is here. He's already spoken his parting words. He doesn't have access to words anymore. Plus, for all intents and purposes, he's dead. He's not going to be singing this song yet. What have we got? We've got this cello. And the cello comes more and more vibrantly, more and more purposefully to life as the song unfolds. Until by the time they get to their final sort of iteration of this line we've heard so many times before, and trickles down through the mountain, the cello isn't playing a bass line at all. The cello is adding a fully independent third harmony part. Let's just hear the song again and follow it down. It's only about 2.5 minutes long.
Who let my kiss and broker's who?
cello, a fully independent thinker. That the words are calling for a kind of faith, a faith in something that simply isn't rationally tenable. Must I accept his fate? Well, yeah, you must. He's dead. You must accept that. Yet here she is singing this song. And there's this sense that in this realm of music, in this place where it is possible to draw a kind of metaphorical correspondences between that which is corporeal and that which is perhaps unrepresentable in real terms. That is, we got the two women, those we get. You know, we understand the two women going through the movie. But we've also got this cello. And, you know, the cello represents absence at the same time that it represents presence. It represents the absent man. And he is at once absent and present. He is wordless, yet musical. That's a really touching thought, isn't it? I don't know. I'm just deeply moved by this song. I don't know. Other thoughts about this? What about the nutty rhythm? That is, do we notice the way she keeps kind of messing around with these things? Well, I recall his parting words. Must I accept his fate? That is, at that point, we've gotten used to sort of three-beat measures. One, two, da, three, da, one, two, da, three, da, one, two, da, one, two, da, three, da, one. That is, she just sort of leaves out a beat for the heck of it. And she's able to do the same thing at the end of the chorus, where she just throws in an extra beat. And separates to the widow from the bride, 2, 3, 1. And that is, that in order to sort of fit in that widow from the bride thing, we just have to throw in an extra beat. And separates to the widow from the bride. And so we have to throw in a fourth beat. Yet, is there any place where she sort of departs from that pattern? That is, she establishes, especially in the verses, I mean, this nice pattern of just kind of throwing in a two-beat measure every so often. Yeah.
The last lines of the second verse, she really throws it off.
Yeah, the dawn of day.
Yeah.
Close to the day of dawn, why would I want to dust you as a
man? Right.
Really throws it off. Mm-hmm.
She does. Yet, when she gets through the first four lines of that verse, and if we are sort of 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3-ing our way through it, we have this, a man goes beyond his own decision, gets caught up in the mechanism of swindlers. And suddenly everything added up to three that time. The moment that she got into this mechanism, everything added up. That is, we expected her to say, gets caught up in something. You know, that's where she's supposed to drop her beat, but she doesn't. She doesn't have a chance to this time. She's got too many syllables to get out. Gets caught up in the mechanism of swindlers. And isn't there this tragic sense that she represents a fierce independence? She represents somebody who understands that there's this fabric, this metrical framework, this 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, to which all mortals are answerable. Yet, she's going to buck it. And she bucks it time after time. Well, heck, I'm just going to give you two beats this time, and then we're going to go on to another measure. Yet, man gets caught up in the mechanism of swindlers. And once you're caught in that mechanism, there are these moments when you just can't get away. And isn't there something about the way that she gets trapped in this sort of simple 3 plus 3 plus 3 plus 3 as she tries to talk her way through the mechanisms of these swindlers? I don't know. And she has to sort of cash in her independence as she does it.
Any significance to the fact that she adds an extra syllable basically to swindlers? She does it as swindlers.
Swindlers, yeah. Yeah. I don't know. What do you think?
I don't know.
I mean, our songwriters give that syllable a note. You got to do something with it. Swindlers. Yeah. Elvis Costello loves nothing more than the sort of cute pun. He's just a wordsmith, first and foremost. And when he talks about the brokers who break everything, you want to sort of laugh. But the fact that you're sitting there laughing only makes it all the more painful. You sort of come back to earth where the song is concerned and say, heck, we're talking about the Civil War here.
It's kind of like the rest of the piece as opposed to a melody or something.
That's a great question. Right, and recitative is this thing invented around 1600 to accommodate all those great stretches of text in opera where nobody's really singing a song, nobody's really at an emotional, you know, train platform getting off to sort of lay a big emotional thing on you. They just got to get through the plot. In American musicals, this is where people talk, which would seem to be the logical thing to do. But in Italian opera, no, they have to sing. And so they developed this kind of singing style that was sort of halfway between speech and song. And we get it only every so often in moments like, a long, long time ago, I can still remember how that music used to make me smile. You know, that's recitative, more or less.
American Pie! American Pie!
Yeah, and so we have to kind of work our way through it. That's how recitative works. Right, in a certain sense, that's what this feels like. You know, song that's answerable to speech rhythms. There's another hand up over here. No. Yeah. Well, other thoughts about this thing? You'll notice I've talked enough that we don't have time for Celine Dion, and I'm sure that there's Celine Dion in the room. But the Titanic soundtrack does offer us a whole other take on this issue of just what you do with the absent beloved. And in that case, she has this sort of My Heart Will Go On thing going. Eric.
And I noticed that that movie won 11 Oscar nominations.
Yep.
And it's also on the jukebox as a new artist for 1999.
Yep.
And it's like one of the best songs. Aren't like the very, very first summer we came up as a family, and I what the heck is going on? Aren't the very first time I ever heard this soundtrack. I heard is this, the music from the movie that was orchestra?
And it's one of those interesting sort of moments of sort of conjunction between the craft of film music writing, the craft of pop music writing, which was written by Michael Kamen, a film scorer, who's not a great pop songwriter, and this song doesn't disprove that premise, but I mean, I don't know. It's a song that really feels like a pop song written by a film scorer guy. And I wish we'd had time to get into it. But we don't, and we'll have to just press on. Thank you all very much, and hope to see many of you tomorrow.